Hello and welcome to the Autism Mums podcast.
I'm Victoria.
And I'm Natalie.
We're two sisters raising autistic children who know the joy, the challenges and the everyday moments.
This is a supportive space for honest conversations, practical tips, shared strength and expert advice.
Whether you're celebrating a win, surviving a meltdown or just trying to make it through the day, we're right here with you.
Join us as we share the ups, the downs, and everything in between parenting autistic children.
Today we're talking about something that affects so much of everyday life for our autistic children and families, and that is sensory differences. If you've ever wondered why a child can cope with one environment but completely fall apart in another, why socks feel unbearable, why a supermarket can cause huge overwhelm, or why some children seek constant movement, noise, or pressure, then this episode is for you.
We also want to say at the start that sensory differences aren't about being fussy, or it's not bad behaviour or being difficult. These are real differences in how the brain receives and processes and responds to sensory information. The National Autistic Society explains that sensory processing happens in the brain and that sensory processing differences are not the same as a problem with like the eyes or the ears or the skin or the organs themselves. Today we're going to look at what sensory processing actually is, the eight sensory systems and how the different systems can show up in autism, as well as some practical ways that we can support our children.
Okay, so shall we start with the basics? So I know you've covered some of this, but sensory processing is the way that the brain takes in information from the body and the environment, making sense of it, and that helps us to respond. Okay, so going back to the National Autistic Society, they describe it as how your brain interprets information from your senses, the sensory input, and how that affects the way that you feel and react to things around you and the sensations in your body. I guess a simple way to think about this is receive, process, and respond. So we receive the sensory input, we process what it means, and then we respond. But for many autistic children, that process can work quite differently.
And the difference can happen at any stage. So a child might notice a sensation much more strongly than other people. They might hardly notice it at all. They might struggle to filter out background input, or they might receive the input, but interpreting it and deciding what to do with it takes much more effort. That's why sensory differences can affect emotions, behaviour, concentration, eating, sleep, transitions, and relationships. Sensory processing differences can impact eating, sleeping, learning, socialising, self-care, physical health, and mental health.
Don't we know it?
Yeah.
Okay, so when people think about the senses, I guess we usually think about the five senses, you know, the ones that you learn at school, so sight, hearing, smell, touch, and taste. But there are actually eight sensory systems that are commonly talked about in sensory processing. Again, if you go to the National Autistic Society, you can get some further information on this, but they add balance, movement, spatial awareness, and awareness of internal states. So I think it might be useful if we go through them one by one.
Yeah, sure. So sight, or the visual system, is how we process what we see. So things like light, colour, movement, clutter, and patterns. Some children are really affected by bright lights or fluorescent lighting, messy visual environments, or too much movement in a room. Bright lights, visually crowded spaces, and patterned environments can be common triggers for hypersensitivity.
For my children, yes, certainly the bright lights. Do yours have trouble with bright lights?
One of them does particularly, and I think crowds as well, or busy places.
Oh gosh, yes, 100%. One of my children, from when they were really young, would wear sunglasses into preschool. And I remember people commenting, oh, you know, that's so cool. It's such a cool look. But years later, we realised there was a good reason for that. And I think it's, like you say, the bright light, but I also know that they do it in crowded spaces as well.
Okay, that's interesting. I tend to deal with it by having lots of different pairs of sunglasses in different bags, in the car, so that I'm not actually looking for them.
Oh, me too.
And then I don't get the guilt about forgetting them because they're already where they should
Yeah,
be.
sunglasses everywhere. One year, one of my children had a party on the beach, and for the party bags, we did up these buckets and spades. I don't know if you remember. And I bought a massive set of sunglasses, and we had far too many. But actually, we just used the spares. They're in all the bags, they're in the car, they're in everything.
That's brilliant. Yeah, and one of my children struggles with the supermarket. I think that can be quite a common one because it's quite a big place. There's lots going on in a supermarket. It can be really busy. The bright lights, sometimes there's music playing as well. So, yeah, we minimize those trips.
Yeah, I remember taking one of your children to the supermarket and noticing that they were really struggling. Again, this is early days where we didn't realize what a trigger it was. And afterwards, I believe I dropped them home to you and they had a massive meltdown. So,
Yeah.
yeah, one of my children avoids supermarkets.
Right.
What about hearing? So I think that's a really important one. So when we talk about hearing, I mean loud noises, sudden noises, background chatter, music, humming appliances, or even the sound of someone eating. Oh, one of my children, I would say one of my children, I think both of them hate this. It's not something I'm fond of either. But yeah, one of my children, they just can't be in the same room as someone eating. I mean, more reason than that, but certainly the sounds.
Yeah, sound is a big issue in my house. Both of my children are sensitive to noise, and I can be as well. I also think we have the loudest blender in the world. It's really good, it's really effective, but it sounds like someone's digging up the road outside whenever I put it on.
Oh my
So
goodness.
if I'm going to use it when the kids are at home, I tend to give them notice that I'm about to put it on. And I make sure that I'm in the room with my youngest child just to give her that support.
Yeah, I think it's quite common, isn't it, that things like loud speech, background noise alarms, or the electrical hummings can be really common sound triggers for some autistic people. And I didn't understand why. I actually saw the TV program where a teenager made a video about what it was like for him to experience sounds and going into busy places. And that really helped me picture what it must be like for my children. That it's basically explained to me that some children, they hear everything at once and they can't tune out what doesn't matter. So, like, we're tuning out all the time. I've always think I've been quite good at tuning out, reading a book while I'm watching the television, don't even hear the
Yeah, I don't know
television.
how you do. I don't
But
know how you do that.
yeah, but I think for some autistic people, they can't do that at all. There's no filtering, is there, of the sounds?
Yeah, something I've invested for myself recently is a pair of loops, the ear plugs. They are so good. And the pair that I have a switch on them, so you can switch them according to how much you want to drown out or what kind of environments you're in. I just love them. They're amazing.
I do really like loops. I bought some after my head injury to protect from loud noises, but we actually all got them, well, me and the children, and use them in different environments for sure.
So another one is smell. Some children are very aware of smells that other people barely notice. For example, cleaning products, food smells, perfume, school halls, toilets, even the smell of a person's clothes. And this can make places feel unsafe or unbearable really quickly.
Yeah, it's a real issue in our household for sure. Just an example, one of my children seems to have such a strong sense of smell that they can tell if I enter the door to a room carrying a plate of chicken nuggets, if that is the right brand or if it's not.
What? Oh my goodness.
Yeah,
Wow.
it's very hard to work around.
Yeah. Is it Jo Malone that has the candles?
Yeah.
She has a really strong sense of smell. I remember hearing a podcast with her being interviewed, and that's how she got into the candle making, is because her sense of smell is super, super strong. Yeah, that's the foundation of her business, which is quite
Oh my
interesting.
goodness, that's so interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Oh, so she surrounded herself with nice smells.
Exactly. Yeah, one of my children is really sensitive to smells, so much so that if she doesn't like something that I'm eating, she can be sick from that. So it can really affect kids,
Yeah,
people.
it really can. And I think taste is another one that we should talk about because that really affects eating and drinking. It ties in so closely with smell, of course, but You might see this showing up as really strong food preferences, a refusal of certain textures or temperatures, or needing foods to be very predictable. This is just our life, really. But as you know, for a lot of families, these sensory differences are a huge part of meal times. Yeah, it's just, I know that your children struggle with it too.
They both do. Meal times, we try to keep them really relaxed. So one of my children will sit on the sofa watching TV to zone out while eating the food, as that's how they cope. The other will sit at the table, but it's still quite a battle. And the preferences of the different foods, they don't like some foods to touch others on the plate. So I often separate it out into one of those plates with the different sections on, which helps. And sometimes I put things in separate bowls as well. So the sauces can be in a separate bowl, and that all helps to reduce the anxiety.
Yeah, both of my children have anxiety around eating. For one, it's more intense than the other. So I think all those things that you've talked about, it's the taste, it's the textures, it's the temperatures, and it's the predictability of the food. One of them had a CAMS appointment and I was trying to explain the difficulties with foods. And my child was being asked, why is it that you like food in wrappers? It's predictable. You get a Yorkie bar, it's the same Yorkie bar. Everyone you unwrap. It's the same, isn't it? It's predictable, it's safe. So, yeah,
And I
this is.
think that's why fruit is often off the list, because sometimes a strawberry can taste sweet and sometimes it can taste sour, and that's untrustworthy, isn't it?
Yeah, for sure. When I did the BEAT eating disorder course, they mentioned blueberries being really tricky. So, blue on the outside, isn't it? It's like a pale color on the inside. So, that's not safe either. And so, I find that. My child, who likes the packaged food particularly, doesn't like soft center chocolate. But I think that is, again, it's not the same as it is on the outside as in the inside. And it's that need for predictability.
And touch is another one, or the tactile system. So that's about texture, pressure, temperature, and physical contact. That might mean that clothes labels feel painful, or certain fabrics feel unbearable. Hair brushing is distressing, or unexpected touch feels shocking. Crowded places, unexpected touch, and certain fabric or food textures are common triggers for some autistic people. And both of my children find clothing difficult. So we tend to take labels out. Collars can sometimes be hard to tolerate. Hair brushing for one of my children in particular is really difficult. I tend to offer to do it for them and make sure that they're ready for the brush before I do it really gently. This usually works okay. But I didn't realize until recently that one of my children, the same one that finds the brushing difficult, finds, when you towel dry the hair when they get out of the bath or the
Yeah.
shower. My child actually finds that painful, like really painful. And I feel terrible because I just chuck the towel over and give it a little rub. But now I know I have to really think hard not to do that.
Do you find that tolerance to clothing is a variable thing?
Yeah, I
Yes.
do. Yes. Sometimes they can wake up and feel terrible and can't tolerate much at all. Other days can tolerate the collars and even
Yeah.
labels sometimes.
That's interesting because that's what I find too. I think it depends how high all those other anxieties and struggles are. And if it's a bad day, I certainly know a bad period that clothing needs to be as soft as possible, or if they can tolerate any, it needs to be soft. Yeah, it's interesting.
It is.
Okay, so shall we talk about the three sensory systems that people often know less about? So vestibular. Oh, that's one that's come up for me lately. That's the sense of balance and movement. So it helps us know if we're moving, spinning, tipping, speeding, or slowing down. And again, you can look this up on the National Autistic Society. They've got some really useful information about it. And they describe it as keeping your body balanced and moving how you expect it to. If a child is seeking vestibular input, they might be loving spinning, swinging, or jumping. If they've got a more sensitive system, they may dislike things like escalators, swings, climbing, or having their feet off the ground.
One of my children in particular loves to swing and jump and spin. I think my child started that in my tummy and never stopped. I remember being at the park when they were about 2 or 3 years old, and I just had to push the swing for so long, just didn't ever want to get out of the swing, and it was really hard to get them to move on to anything else. I
Yeah.
think they would have just stayed there all day.
I know that's certainly true of your children.
Another system is proprioception. So this is our sense of our body position. So where our body is in space. That's knowing where your body is in relation to other objects as well. This system helps with force and coordination, and it can affect things like bumping into furniture, pressing too hard or too lightly, chewing on things, crashing into cushions, or needing deep pressure. A lot of what people call rough play or constant movement can actually be a child trying to get that sensory information their body needs. Again, one of my children loves rough play and constant movement. They love the deep pressure and will ask us to lie on them.
A good few years ago, when professionals were treating my child's different struggling aspects, and we went to different professionals for different things, when it was an occupational therapist, and I remember them saying that my child had poor proprioception. And I remember becoming really aware of it. We tried out a karate class, me and both my children, who were quite little at the time, and you had to copy what the instructor was doing. And one of my children just couldn't do it. And it tied in very much with what the occupational therapist was saying. It was a real struggle to know where their arm was in relation to, their body. Copying movements just wasn't easy at all.
Wow, that's
Yeah.
really interesting.
Yeah, these things that you think are a given, they're not for everybody.
No.
And finally, there's interoception. This is the awareness of your internal body signals, things like hunger, thirst, needing the toilet, pain, temperature, nausea or tiredness, an awareness of internal states such as knowing if you are hungry, if you're thirsty, if you're hot, if you're cold, if you need the toilet, or if you're ill and if you're injured. And when someone's system works differently, this can look like a child not knowing that they're hungry until they're completely dysregulated, or they might not know that they need the toilet until the last possible second when they're desperate or it's too late. One of my children in particular struggles with all these things. Hunger can be a really hard one, just not recognizing it, not recognizing it, not recognizing thirst. Maybe saying, oh, I've got tummy ache. And then you need to go through, like, could you be hungry? Could you need the toilet? Can we try some of these different things? Because to them, it's not easily identifiable.
Yeah, mine definitely experienced this too. I find prompting helps with trips to the toilet. And I tried to keep tabs on when their last snack and drink was, as I just don't think they feel hunger and thirst in the same way.
No, I think you're right.
Sensory differences are very common in autism. So the research suggests somewhere between 53% and 95% of autistic people experience sensory processing differences. Sensory differences are considered as part of autism assessment under restricted and repetitive behaviours and interests, although sensory differences are not required for diagnosis. So this is not a niche issue, it's central for many autistic people.
That's interesting. I think this is where it's helpful to talk about oversensitivity and undersensitivity. You may have heard the terms hypersensitive and hyposensitive. If a child is oversensitive, it means that input can feel too much, too fast, too loud, too bright, too itchy, too strong. Whereas if a child's undersensitive, they may not register enough input and they may seek more. That looks like more movement, more pressure, more sound, more chewing, more crashing, more sensation. Autistic people can be much more or much less sensitive to sensory experience than non-autistic people. And because of that, they may seek out or avoid or become overwhelmed by sensory input.
And also, a child could be oversensitive in one system but undersensitive in another. So they might be very distressed by sound but constantly seeking movement. They might hate certain textures but crave deep pressure. They might not notice hunger, but they might be overwhelmed by lighting. So sensory profiles are individual. There isn't one autistic sensory experience. I think this one's quite a big one to get your head around, isn't it?
Yeah, it's massive. Another term that you may have come across is sensory defensiveness. And this is when the nervous system reacts to certain sensations as though they are threatening, even if other people experience them as ordinary. So that can be like a clothing seam or a hand dryer. Oh my goodness. A haircut. toothpaste or crowded corridor might not just be unpleasant, it might be unbearable or unsafe. Now, sensory inputs other people barely notice can cause discomfort and even pain, as you said before, Nat, and avoiding them is just not the same as disliking something. It's quite a different distinction that matters.
Yes, definitely. I've definitely seen this with mine. Hand dryers is a big one.
Hand dryers is massive, isn't it? Both of mine struggled with hand dryers. Again, that was another early sign. I remember avoiding the toilets. If people are in there, those hand dryers are going to go off. Oh, toothpaste. Don't get me started on toothpaste.
I know, that one's a tricky one, isn't it?
Yeah, one of my children is currently on a tasteless, non-foaming toothpaste, which seems to work best. And the other has a specific flavour. I think it's strawberry. Toothpaste has been quite an issue for us.
Yeah, it's a hard one.
As a crowded corridors, when we went on holiday, when it was dinner time and everybody was walking down those corridors towards the restaurants, that's far too much for one of my children.
Yeah, and I think it can be incorrectly labelled as being dramatic or controlling, oppositional, or just fussy. Fussy is one of the words that comes up a lot. Can't bear it. But often what we're really seeing is a nervous system in distress. And I really wish there was more understanding about this generally.
Yes, so do I. So do I. I think it's like you said, it's that mislabeling of fussy or dramatic, isn't it? Perhaps more so those labels in girls. I don't know what you think, but my daughter has certainly been labeled as dramatic in the
Oh,
past.
yes. Yeah, I agree.
Something that can really help understand sensory overwhelm is the idea that autistic children may need to process one sensory input at a time. So, autistic people often need more time to process and move between different sensory stimuli and can find rapidly changing sensory and social information difficult. Just imagine trying to listen to an instruction, but you're trying to ignore fluorescent lights, and you're trying to cope with the smell of the lunch, and you're trying to tolerate the seam in your sock and work out where your body is in a crowded room all at the same time. That's actually a huge amount of processing.
It really is. And you can see why the school environment can be so difficult for some children.
Oh my gosh. Just also, I'm thinking back to the calls I had about the lunch hall. No, neither of my children coped in the lunch hall. One, I think it was the smells of the food, particularly. And the other, I think it was a lot of it was that busyness and the noise, all those people talking. It's a lot, isn't it?
And I know mine struggled with not being able to sit in the same chair every time.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, another
Makes
thing,
sense.
all those different rules. If a child is already overloaded, adding more language can make things worse. I definitely see this. So that's when you just need to keep your mouth shut. There's enough going on, isn't there? They don't want that. And actually, my child will tell me that now. Not in those words, but he will say, "I need quiet. I need quiet, I need space." And it's really great. Now he can communicate that. But when he was much younger, couldn't at all. And I didn't have a clue what I was doing. So we get there slowly.
Yeah, less is more.
Yeah. So the advice is to keep speech and information to a minimum when someone is already overloaded, because they may not be able to process more sensory or verbal input. So in moments of overwhelm, less can often be more. Short phrases, a calm tone, reduced demands, and fewer words. That definitely works in our house.
Okay. And another important thing that we should talk about is attaching meaning to a sensation. So, not just noticing the sensation, but what meaning the brain gives that sensation. It can be interpreted as dangerous, unexpected, disgusting, painful, exciting, calming, or completely irrelevant. For some children, the buzz of a light fitting is just a sound in the background. For another, that same sound may feel really intrusive, impossible to ignore, and highly stressful.
Yeah, you're taking me back to when we went to Centre Parks. I might have mentioned this
Yes.
before, but in the bathroom there, if you switched on the light, it switched on the fan, and neither of my children could cope with that noise of the fan. So they were having to go in there in the dark, and there was no window in that room either, so it was just a nightmare.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. So when children have repeated negative experiences, they can start to anticipate distress before it even happens, like the school hall, like we were talking about, or a haircut, a swimming lesson, or the dentist may become stressful before it's even started. This is why supporting sensory differences is not about forcing children to just get used to it. It's about understanding the nervous system and reducing unnecessary distress. And I think this really comes into like not trying to fit them into boxes that we call normal. It's just so unfair.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think we should talk about how do you support a child with sensory differences. The advice that I've heard is to always start with curiosity. Find out what is the child experiencing, what seems to trigger that distress, what seems to calm them, what are they seeking, and what are they avoiding. Once you can identify a person's triggers, reactions, challenges, then you can start working on strategies. That can look beyond behaviour and asking what the sensory need might sit underneath it.
Yeah, and the next step is to think about adaptation. Can we change the environment? Can we reduce sensory load? Can we give recovery time? Can we offer alternatives? Can we prepare the child in advance? Support should not begin only after a child is already overwhelmed.
Yeah, I think a helpful framework to think about is calming, alerting, or organizing. Not every activity works in the same way for a child, but these categories can help us think more intentionally. Calming activities would be the ones that reduce overwhelm and support regulation, like could be deep pressure, a firm hug, if a child likes that, or wrapping them up tightly in a blanket, quiet time in a low stimulation place, slow rocking, sucking thick drinks through a straw, chewing safe, chewy items, listening to predictable calming music, heavy comfort objects, and dimmer lighting. One of my children particularly likes the dimmer lighting and the sensory screenings at the cinema. That seems to help hugely.
Oh, that's really interesting, isn't it? We like a weighted blanket, that can be nice and calming. And chewing crunchy foods actually is quite a good one as well, even just ice cubes.
One of my children finds listening to music helpful, but I wouldn't say that it's always traditionally calming. When they were struggling in school, and I think that sound was an issue at this point when they were younger, one of the autism professionals that came in to support my child said it didn't matter what music they were listening to, because what's calming for one person isn't calming for another. So I think just be open to the different types of music that might help your child calm.
Yeah. And I think it's important to say that calming doesn't always mean still. So for some children, calm comes through movement. So a trampoline, like we mentioned before, or rhythmic pacing, swinging, carrying something heavy, or walking can actually be what helps them to regulate. Swinging definitely helps my child, like I said before, and I think that's why they seek it out so much.
Yeah, mine liked trampolining. My younger child still likes trampolining and finds that quite regulating. Unfortunately, we don't have a trampoline anymore because the dog chewed it up, but they very much enjoyed jumping on your trampoline.
Yes.
If your child, though, seems under-responsive and quite sluggish or disconnected, it might be that they need help waking their system up. So you might want to include some alerting activities. That could be things like a brisk walk or bouncing or dancing, cold water on hands or face, crunchy or sour snacks if appropriate, quick movement breaks or upbeat rhythm or music. The idea isn't to overstimulate, but just to help the nervous system become more ready and engaged.
Organising activities that help the brain and body work together can be especially useful before times that require attention, transition, or emotional regulation. So these could be obstacle courses. I've definitely done some of them in my garden many a time. Balancing activities, climbing, pushing or pulling heavy items safely, yoga or animal walks, carrying books or groceries, or tasks that combine movement with planning.
I remember when my younger child was struggling at first school, one of the things they would do to try to regulate them was giving them the milk to carry
Oh, yes,
from the
yeah.
staff room to the classroom. I'm not sure how much my younger child benefits from heavy Things like that, I'm unsure, but that's certainly a strategy that school tried. So let's finish with some general strategies that can make a real difference. Try noticing patterns. This is what we do. Try and keep a track of what happens before distress, shutdown, meltdowns, or refusals. These are really key. The sensory triggers can often be hiding in plain sight. And reduce the sensory load where that's possible. So that could be ear defenders, softer clothing, reducing clutter, dimming the lights, avoiding strong smells, or choosing quieter times or places to do things. I think we do all of these.
Preparing in advance can be a really good one as well. Telling a child what sensory experiences to expect. I know we've used visuals before, or if there's videos available to show what a place would look like, we often show those because I think sometimes my child struggles, even if they've been to a place before, they can't remember. I often get pictures up on my phone of when we were there last time and things like that, which really helps. Bringing sensory supports with you and building in recovery time afterwards. Using less language in overload. So that's something we've mentioned before. So when a child is overwhelmed, long explanations usually won't help. So the National Autistic Society advises keeping speech and information to a minimum during overload. And respect sensory pain. If something feels unbearable, treat it seriously. Avoid turning support into a battle of wills. I think that's a really key one.
I think so, absolutely. And not every child will want the same support. Some will want headphones, but some won't. And some will want movement, and some will want stillness, some will want deep pressure, whereas others will really hate that. So you need to offer choices. The goal is to help them feel safer and more regulated. So think of it as regulation, not compliance. And work with the school and other settings as well, because sensory support does need consistency. It helps when homeschool and clubs have the same understanding.
And finally, remember that behaviour is communication. So, a child who is running away, covering ears, refusing clothes, lashing out, shutting down, and seeming too much may be telling us something important about what their nervous system can and cannot cope with.
So just to recap, we've talked about the eight sensory systems, how sensory processing involves receiving, processing, and responding, and how autistic children may experience the sensory world very differently. We've looked at over and under sensitivity, sensory defensiveness, needing to process one thing at a time, and ways to support children through calming, alerting, and organizing activities.
Most of all, we hope this episode helps you to look at the sensory differences with compassion and curiosity, because when we understand sensory needs better, we can support our children more gently and more effectively and with far less shame.
Thank you so much for listening. Thanks for joining us today on the Autism Mums podcast.
We hope you have found a little support, a little solidarity, and a reminder that you are not in this alone.
If you enjoyed the episode, we'd love it if you'd follow the show and share it with another parent or carer who might need to hear it.
And if you've got a story or a moment you'd like to share, we'd love to hear from you at www.theautismmums.com.
Until next time, take care.